So we're going to make a start.
Put his mind on loving kindness. Let's see that.
This is what should be done by the one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Can we just dim the lights a little bit, please, though? Yeah, it's more soothing. So, it's that. prepare your hearts to receive some Dharma. Because as I've said before, peace and quiet and Dharma go together. The quieter your mind is, the more peaceful it is, the better the penetration of the Dharma that you listen to. Because Dharma goes beyond words. Words are just language. They're part of the conventional world. Dharma isn't. Dharma goes beyond the conventional world. It's both in the world and goes beyond it. But if you can settle your mind, make it comfortable, then you can understand the Dhamma at a level which is even deeper than your understanding of the words. The Dhamma will penetrate your heart because you have the right intention to do good and to forsake those things which are unwholesome. And when you set your mind like this, then you're setting it to receive Dhamma. You're making it complementary. The two go hand in glove. So that's the right way to listen to a talk on Dhamma. When individuals, when people come and first come across the Dharma, Buddhism, they have a choice. They can choose to accept the truth of the Dharma, or they can choose not to. There really is no in between. So when we have encountered the Dharma, we can choose to follow the path that is explained in the teachings of the Buddha, or not. For those who choose the path, they're really, it's the same path for everybody. The only difference between those who follow the path is the level of commitment. The path doesn't change, it doesn't deviate. There isn't one path for somebody tall, so a different path for somebody small, a different path for people who are from the UK, and a different path for those who are from Thailand or Cambodia. No. The path is the same. It's just the speed along the path that you go which determines the difference between the practitioners. Some people choose to go down the path and they take five precepts. Lay people. Some people choose eight precepts. Some people ordain and become a novice and follow 10 precepts. And some people become monks. Regardless of whichever number of precepts you take, the path is still the same. It's just your level of commitment which changes. And even if you decide that you're going to take, say, five precepts, if you don't keep them all the time, well, that's just, again, you slowing down your rate of progress along the path. It's better to be a really good layperson than it is to be a discredited monk. What do I mean by that? Well, in Western Australia, we're quite fortunate. We have a group of monks that we associate with, particularly those associated with the Bodhinyana Monastery and here, Venerable Sukhakarma. They exhibit good practice. They keep their precepts and they're worthy of respect. But that's not the case all over the world. I remember once reading a story a few years ago about a journalist who was in Burma, and she was covering the problems with the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingyas. Thank you. Yeah. And she said, she started out an article, and she was a Reuters correspondent, and she started out her article saying, "I'm walking towards a Buddhist monk who has got hold of a woman and has a knife to her throat and saying, if I were to come any closer, he would slit her throat." Now, there's a lot of things wrong with that statement. Not only is there obviously genuine ill will, which is contrary to the Metta Sutta that we just chanted. Holding a knife is prohibited as a weapon. Monks can't do that. Holding a woman is even more prohibited. And if a monk takes a life, which he was threatening to do, then that's automatic excommunication. That's the worst, one of the worst things that a monk can do. But yet that was the situation. We don't tend to see that because of the good quality of monks that we have here. Well, we're very fortunate to have them, and we should respect the fact that they are practicing, because they are few. Back in, I don't know whether it's still going on or not, but certainly back in the last century, it was common in some places, especially rural places, for monks to have mistresses. They handle money, they eat afternoon, they break all sorts of rules, and yet the lay community still support them. Those who do have mistresses, those who do break the rules in a serious way, they should really no longer be considered monks. So they might shave their head and wear yellow robes, but they're not monks. And the karma that they make is extremely bad. My own teacher, he was asked by the Supreme Patriarch of the Thai Sangha, the Thai Order of Monks, to go down, many years ago now, back in the 50s, early 60s, he was asked to go down to Phuket. Now, we all know Phuket as a holiday destination these days where tourists go, but back then it was anything but. It was quite lawless and really a little bit like the Wild West. And the Supreme Patriarch said to my teacher, we'd like you to go down there, and we'd like you to improve the quality of the monks down there so that lay people can have more faith in the monks. So he went down, at first on his own, and then later some monks joined him. But when he went down there and the other monks saw how he practiced, how he was firm in his resolve to keep the precepts. He didn't eat after lunch, after 12 o'clock. He didn't want to associate with women. He didn't want to gamble. He wanted to practice, and he wanted to have lay people be drawn to that practice. Well, after he'd been there a short while, monks and lay people that the monks had convinced stood by his Vindabhada path and threw stones at him. The karma that those monks made is extremely bad. We don't have monks like that. So you can be a really good lay person and keep your five precepts. So you abstain from killing, you abstain from stealing, you abstain from you abstain from sexual promiscuity, you abstain from falsehood, telling falsehoods, and you abstain from taking intoxicants. And if you keep those sincerely and you genuinely try to promote the good side of your character, the wholesome side, do things by body, speech and mind that are wholesome, and you genuinely try to give up the defilements, greed, anger and delusion, then you genuinely work on improving your own personal development, then you're on the path and you're going in the right direction. Whereas those kind of monks that lay claim to following all the precepts and they shave their head and they wear the robes, they're not making any progress, they're going backwards. So it's not outwardly how we look that makes us progress down the path. It's how we conduct ourselves. And we conduct ourselves through body, speech and mind. So, you may have heard, I'm sure most people here have been coming for quite a while, so they'll know the Eightfold Path, and they will know or the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So, I'm going to talk about right conduct in a different way. Just, I guess, to be a little bit different. So rather than talk about the Eightfold Path, which is the common way of talking about how to progress along the path, I'm going to look at what the Lord Buddha spoke about in terms of conduct, which is becoming those who are looking to progress down the path of Dharma. And the first thing he said was that you should practice charity. You should practice giving. Now, we all know about giving and we all know about donations and things like that. So I'm not going to go over that in the short period that we've got. But what I am going to say is that two of the best things that we can give are, firstly, to give the merit. So the merit that we make in doing good deeds, whether that's being charitable, being virtuous, or practicing meditation, we wish to other beings. And this is what it says here. And I've highlighted this, thanks to Bill. May all beings receive the blessings of my life. And that's what that really means. May all beings receive the blessings of my life. So you share the good things that you do. You share the benefits you hope that beings will share and enjoy, be on the same wavelength as you and share in the merit that you're making. Now, this is important, as is sharing the Dharma. So sharing the Dharma with friends and family, if they choose not to listen, well, that's nothing you can do about that, but you can at least give the opportunity. But you can all, as you practice meditation, you could all wish to share your merit. And last Tuesday, Venerable Kasapa and I, we went down to a cemetery to practice meditation. So we both sat for an hour in the cemetery. And obviously, one of the reasons is to try and recollect that this body is going to break up and we're all going to die. It's a meditation on death. But as I sat there, when I first started, and I wished all beings well, and I thought, may all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings share in the merit that I'm making now by practicing my meditation. Then a thought occurred to me. Well, I thought to myself, gee, if I don't practice very well, then I'm not going to have much merit for them to share. By the time they're all picking at this, then they'll be fairly slim pickings. So it's incumbent on me now, if I'm going to share this merit, to try and do my best to practice well, to develop my meditation and still my mind, so that all these beings that were associated with that cemetery, may they all be happy, may they all benefit, may they all come on the wavelength and understand the Dharma. Wherever they've been reborn, whatever they're doing now, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering. And that's something we can all do, and that's being charitable. Now, I've just gone over the five precepts, but virtue is the next thing, to be virtuous. To keep one's five precepts, to try and avoid ill will, to try and avoid coveting the neighbour's possessions, being envious and things like that. Your precepts are designed there to provide a gross sort of, perhaps gross is the wrong way, but provide a less than subtle way of guarding your mind from garnering all of these unwholesome thoughts. Precepts are like policies. When you get the opportunity and you look, oh, there's that spider. Am I going to kill it or not kill it? I don't like spiders. Well, the answer is no, you're not going to kill it because you're going to keep your precepts, whether you like spiders or whether you don't. So you don't have to think about it. It becomes second nature. So you don't do it. You pick the spider up and you put it outside. They're like policies. And it doesn't matter. When you go to a social event and people say, would you like a drink? And you say no. You don't have to think about it. You just say no. Because you don't take alcohol. Because you know that it clouds the mind. And once you've embraced the precepts and you keep the precepts, then you gain the benefit of starting to slow the mind down at this rudimentary level of physical actions. So next thing the Lord Buddha said was you should be modest in what you eat. So you're not greedy and you don't always look for fine foods. You're content with the meals that you get. So you don't go looking for indulgence in food. You eat in moderation because you only really need to eat to support the body. You don't need to eat to excess. Same with sleep. The next one is sleep. So you're moderating the amount of sleep that you have, because while you're asleep, you're not meditating and you're not learning Dhamma. So if you can keep your sleep down to a minimum, yeah, everyone has to sleep. That's not the point. To practice here means to limit the amount of sleep that one has so that one can keep the mind bright and one can have time to practice. Next, we need to have some faith. Now, faith has got a very Christian connotation to it, and that's not the kind of faith that I'm talking about here. I'm not even talking about faith in the Buddha and faith in the Dhamma and faith in the Sangha. When you become a Buddhist, you generally, being a Buddhist means that you take refuge in the Buddha, you take refuge in his teachings, and you take refuge in those monks that have followed his teachings. They become the three pillars that you believe in. But here I'm talking about faith specifically in the law of karma. Because we don't know about karma, really. We can understand it intellectually, but really we haven't seen it for ourselves, for most of us anyway. How it works is a mystery. It's one of the imponderables, along with the power of the Buddha, the power of Jhana, and what was the start of the universe or the cosmos. It's one of how karma works in the fine detail. Not even the Lord Buddha knew the nature of that. He just said, well, what we have now is a life that has resulted from karma, and that life is suffering, and here's the path out. Don't waste your time thinking about how we got here in the first place, because it's just a waste of mental energy. But if you have faith in karma, then what that does is it sets you up for the next kinds of action, which is, the two go hand in hand. In Pali they call them hiriya notaba, and that is that you have a fear, a dread of doing the wrong thing, of being, of developing unwholesome characteristics, and that you fear the results of that, because you know that if you believe in karma, if you have faith in karma, that if you do something which is unwholesome, then you're going to suffer. Because karma is basically the law of cause and effect. If you build up bad or unwholesome causes, you get unwholesome results. Next is experience. Learning. So it's important to try and expand your understanding, particularly of the Dhamma, so that you can better start to understand what is Dhamma and what is not. And that is fundamental to having right view, which is the first step of the Noble Eightfold Path, to have right view. Right view that this world is suffering, that the Four Noble Truths are the way out. So, learning can be through listening to other people, listening to a teacher, reading appropriate material, and practicing meditation. They're all forms of learning, and they're all to be encouraged. An effort. You have to put in effort. An effort is the same here as it is in the Noble Eightfold Path. So promoting all the good qualities that you've got, trying to maintain all those qualities and trying to develop new good qualities. And trying to abandon the unwholesome qualities that we have in our personality, whether they be because we're covetous or because we're greedy or because we get angry or whatever. We try to control those as much as we can. And we try to prevent new unwholesome characteristics from developing in us. That's right effort. And we have right mindfulness. And mindfulness is an interesting quality. What does mindfulness really mean? We practice meditation and we want to be mindful. Mindfulness is a tool. It is part of our mind. It's part of our the word citta. I've used that before. I'll use it again here. It's an active mind. And sometimes we have mindfulness and sometimes we don't. And in the first instance, when we're trying to meditate, mindfulness, awareness of our meditation subject, it's like the tether which binds the observer with the observed. But the tether's weak and it breaks. And we no sooner got attached to the meditation subject than boop, we're gone again. That's when we start. But the more we practice, the stronger the tether becomes. Until in the end, it's no longer a tether. Mindfulness and the citta become one and the same. So then you're mindful all the time. And mindfulness wraps around the mind and helps control not so much control, but helps understand sense objects as they arise. So things that we see, things that we hear, taste, touch, smell. So when they arise, through whatever sense door, mindfulness does, this has arisen. We know this. It's arisen, it'll arise for a while, and then pass away. And the job of mindfulness there is to stop the citta from becoming engaged with those external objects. Because that's where our suffering arises, because we want those external objects to display characteristics that are not in their nature. We want them to last forever, the things that we like, and we want the things that we don't like to disappear immediately. And the world doesn't bend to our will. And while we try and make it bend to our will, then we'll experience suffering. What we really need to do is to understand the world the way it is, not try and change it. It's ourselves that we need to change, not the world. And that brings me to the next quality, and that is wisdom. When you have mindfulness, you can develop wisdom. When you don't have mindfulness, you can't, basically, because you can't see things as they are. You're not aware of things. The defilements get hold of you and pollute your mind. The defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion pollute your mind before you have a chance to catch up with them. You see something you like and whoop, the mind's out there, gone. And that's what happens when you don't have mindfulness. When you have mindfulness and you can see what's happening, you're aware. And you can say, oh, hang on, something's arisen. Now, I'm not going to go get involved with that. I'm not going to say this is beautiful, this is really nice, this is enjoyable, I want this, I don't want that. No, because that's the way of the world. So whatever you see arise, you know that it's arisen. Watch it for a while, and you see it's life's over, it passes away. sensual stimulation. It's all the same. Whatever sense you choose, even the mind itself, as it thinks, thoughts, has feelings, they arise, they're there for a while, they pass away. They arise, pass for a while, pass away. And understanding that is wisdom. Understanding that is how you develop the path that is free from suffering. And the final four courses of action, which I won't go into in any great detail, are the four jhanas. I spoke about jhana last week. I'm not going to go over it again. But basically, the first four jhanas, the first four rupa jhanas, are the last things that we should develop. And when I label things and put them out in the order that I have, it doesn't mean to say that you progress from one to another, that you can't have, that they go in that order. You can do all of those a little bit at a time. You can have lots of things going on all at once. That's not a step-by-step approach. It's just the qualities, the virtues that you need to have if you're going to conduct yourself properly according to the way that the Lord Buddha taught. So if you can remember those things, and even more, if you can practice them, then you will be following the path that the Lord Buddha laid down as the path to be free from suffering. So it doesn't matter whether you have five precepts or whatever your status may be. If you're following that path, you are making some progress. And if you're not following that path and not conducting yourself, it doesn't matter whether you're ordained, shave your head, or whether you're living in a monastery, whether you're living in the middle of the forest, or whether you're living in the middle of the city, it doesn't matter. Then you're not practicing Buddhism. You can call yourself a Buddhist, doesn't matter. You're not practicing what the Lord Buddha taught. So what I've outlined now, tonight, is basically the core practice of Dharma for body, speech and mind. And if you practice that way, then you'll be able to share your merit and we'll all be able to benefit from it. So that's enough for me tonight. Here one. So we'll practice some meditation. So you've all got your meditation subject. So I want you to focus your attention on your meditation subject. And then I want you to repeat to yourself, just observe. Two words. Just observe. Just observe your meditation subject. Don't get involved with it. Just observe any disturbances that you have. Don't go out and engage with those disturbances. Just observe them. Just repeat, just observe. That's all we're trying to do. Just observe. And if, when you're just observing, bring your mind, if you're distracted, you bring your mind back to your meditation subject, and just keep saying to yourself, just observe. If when you're observing, you see a world of confusion out there, with your mind spinning around, remember you are just observing. And the problem is not that your mind is spinning around, that there's lots of confusion. The problem is your attachment to the confusion. So you just need to observe and let the confusion go its own way. And if you just observe, just stand back, just watch, eventually the confusion will go. Just observe. now as we start to come to the end of our meditation. Focus our energy as we breathe in. Down into our chest. As we breathe out, feel that energy, that calmness spread throughout your body. Feel the energy extend beyond your limbs. Expanding all directions. And wish all beings freedom from suffering. Open your eyes. We will finish and take any questions. So, has anybody got any questions before we chant our last bit of chanting? Happy to talk about any aspect of Dharma or meditation. Doesn't have to be related to the talk.
No, I'm going to use according to everything imponderable.
The imponderables.
The imponderable.
Hmm.
An interesting word.
Well, there are several subject matters which the Lord Buddha basically scorned. They said they're just a waste of your time trying to think of what the answer is to the questions, if you like. So, when did the cosmos start? Was one, and he, it's said, the tradition is that when he became enlightened at the foot of the Bodhi tree, he sent his mind back through countless lifetimes trying to find the beginning of the cosmos, and he went through thousands and thousands and thousands of lifetimes, and he couldn't find the beginning, so he gave up. He just said, even I can't know this. It's just too hard to know. What happened in the beginning, when it all started, don't know. Don't care. Because the issue there is not how it started, but what is life like now? What is reality for us now? Reality is that suffering is our reality. We're born into a world. We get older. We experience pain and suffering, illness, sickness, and then some of us live long enough to experience old age, and then we die. And the same is true for every being. There are no beings that live forever. And so his priority was to teach people the way to be free from this, because that's what he'd done for himself. He found the way himself. And so he taught others how to accomplish the same thing as him, freedom from suffering. So any effort that you make to try and ponder the imponderables, like the beginning of the world, or how karma works, or what the power of the Buddha is, or what the power of jhana is, then that's time wasted from actually travelling along the path. So that's why they're imponderables. But he was also asked questions like, well, when you're enlightened, when you die, what happens? Do you exist or don't you exist? Do you both exist and not exist, or do you neither exist or not exist? And he just refused to answer, because in that particular case, those particular questions, they're all premised on what enlightenment means. And it's very difficult to describe, because it's not in our nature to understand enlightenment. Day to day, we live in a world which is the conventional world, where there's hot and cold, black and white, good and bad. And enlightenment involves none of those things. Enlightenment is void of all of those kind of duality. It's void of self. And so it's almost impossible to understand in conventional language. And so he just said, you practice and you find out for yourself, basically, rather than try and inadequately explain in words what enlightenment is about. So there are certain things, like the imponderables, which Buddhism doesn't really address, and that's the reason why, because it's almost a waste of people's effort. Their effort is better directed towards treading the path than following the code of conduct that I've basically outlined to you today.
You call Kama imponderable, but I mean, on the other hand, I think we should have a basic understanding of Kama, as in, you know, like the saying, you know, what you sow is what you reap.
Yes, it's true. At that level, that's true. But that's very basic. How karma interacts, how your karma interacts with my karma.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, oh, it's just karma. But actually, no, events happen that aren't just based on karma. And sometimes karma intersects, and whose karma then wins out. You can then change the direction of your karma because of an accident. So the intricacies of how karma works across the whole cosmos, that's unfathomable. But at a gross level, which is what I was saying before, if you build a store of good causes, you get good results. And if you build a store of unwholesome actions and thoughts, then you get and that basic level, you can have faith that karma works. It's the law of cause and effect. But at the finite level of exactly how does it each individual piece move, even the Lord Buddha didn't know that.
Yeah, because saying group karma is another one of those sort of things that's imponderable, because people say, like with the 9/11, for instance, you know, 30,000 people died, you know, it's sort of like group karma of almost 3,000 people, but obviously that's not the case. But
it doesn't have to be. Not everything is karma.
Mm.
If it was, there'd be no way out. So your life is not predestined. In the Abhidhamma, which a lot of monks don't like, and I, the Abhidhamma is the third Pitaka. There is the Vinaya, the third group of teachings, if you like. There's the rules of the monk, the Vinaya. There's the Sutta Pitaka, which is the teachings of the Lord Buddha in the form of talks. And then there's the third one, which is the Abhidhamma, which is the higher Dhamma. Supposedly, the tradition is that because the Lord Buddha's mother died when he was born, she lives in the Tusita heaven, and that after he was enlightened, he visited her in that heavenly realm, and he taught her the Abhidhamma. And so that's a detailed explanation of how the mind works, basically, very detailed, how consciousness arises and passes away, the different types of consciousness, that there are 16 types of consciousness within every sense object, and all of that's explained in the Abhidhamma, and what the difference is in terms of the different components of the mind, all explained in the Abhidhamma. I've just lost my train of thought there. What were we talking about? Karma. So within that stream of consciousness that occurs with every sense object, free will occurs only one moment of consciousness out of 16 or 17, depending on the type of sense object. And that's a moment of consciousness that in Pali we call vajapa. That's just my alarm. And that's the time that you make karma. Before the moments of consciousness, before that stage, they're all the result of previous karma. At that stage, it's the very present moment when you make a decision to do something. And then after that, it's the result of your decision. And that's a very detailed explanation in the Abhidhamma. But basically, humans do have an option to change their life, if you like. It's not predestined that we will be something. But unless we take the opportunity of making the right decisions at the right time, then karma is a major influence that will determine how our life unfolds. But it's not the only influence. And we can do something about it, because if we couldn't, then no one would be enlightened. Okay? So, over to Bill.
Now understand the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be
disturbed. Thank you for your attendance.